This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Writer Travis Mulhauser grew up in a small rural town on the coast of Lake Michigan before the digital revolution. His community was geographically and culturally isolated, and he describes life there as living in a rural underworld. And for the most part, Travis was a bystander, watching his friends do wild and crazy things while he observed from the sidelines. In his adult life, those observations have become fodder for his writing and shaped his debut novel, Sweet Girl. The book follows the story of 16-year-old Percy James, whose search for her mother in northern Michigan in the dead of winter takes her on an unexpected journey. Travis got his MFA at UNC Greensboro and now lives in Durham and joins me in the studio. Travis, welcome to the State of Things. Good day.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
It's good. Great to have you. Tell us a little bit more about where you grew up in Michigan.
Well, Petoskey is a small town right on the coast of Lake Michigan.
He's holding up the mitten right now, folks.
Yeah,
for those of you in Michigan, the mitten
is before us.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
And it's super beautiful geographically, and it is often described as sort of cute. And it's a resort destination. But it's also, you know, when you live there year-round, there's other parts of it. And there's, you know, when you get out into the rural areas, it can get a little dicier and a little less like something you'd want to put on a postcard. And so that's sort of what Sweet Girl looks at. And I don't, you know, I was on the sidelines for a lot of that stuff, but I got in the game once in a while. Just long enough to sort of realize that my place was back on the bench. But
well, I mean, I know there's one episode that I think will illustrate both your role and what you did and didn't do, and a little bit about where it was. A friend of yours who purloins, I think, hit a liquor store, but the getaway is the punchline.
Well, yeah, so this is one. As soon as I said it, I was like, maybe I shouldn't have said that. I was talking to Anita, the producer, about a friend of mine that committed a crime in which the escape vehicle was a canoe. And it's not that it was the canoe because it was like, oh, cool, I'm going to go do this and escape on a canoe. It was like the best way to escape was in a canoe. And I just remember, this was in high school, and I remember being struck by the fact that, like, there's something here. Like, there's something really interesting
about
this.
From the land of sky blue waters.
Yeah,
the
whole fur traders thing, and, you know.
So when did you start having those kind of thoughts, that there's something here, that this is, I mean, again, you're not the guy in the canoe. You didn't hit whatever it was that got knocked off that night. So you're an observer, and at a certain point, you know, observers become writers. When did that happen to you?
I think it happened kind of as I left northern Michigan and saw other places and realized, like, you know, there's something to this area and to these people that when you grow up in a place you might not be as aware of. I just wanted to get out of my small town. But once I got out, I found myself only wanting to write about that place and seeing it in contrast to other places was really fascinating.
So tell us more about Sweet Girl and how that plays out.
Yeah, so Sweet Girl is based on this image I had of a girl discovering an abandoned baby in a meth house. And I don't know where that image came from, but I was sort of possessed by it. And the girl was a young girl in a hooded sweatshirt, and I had the sense that she was in as much trouble as the baby somehow. And a lot of writers talk about how books will start with an image, and that was the image for me. And so the sort of panning out from that image, it became the story about this the narrator, Percy James, and her search for her meth-addicted mother and how it leads her to this baby, and then her sort of snap decision to pick the baby up and to try and get it to safety.
I mean, it's a wonderful way to develop the story because you've got, you know, in terms of the action, it moves very quickly. It is, as some people have described it as a thriller, but it's certainly got a lot of action. Things are moving from place to place. But metaphorically, you've got these two lives at stake that are intertwined and a kind of rescue of self and other that can be seen kind of bundled as one. It's a nice work of art here.
Thank you.
So read for us and prove what I said is kind of correct.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do my best. So this is Percy, and she's driving through Cutler County, which is the fictionalized version of Petoskey, on her way to look for her mother. Our block was all beat down Reynolds and busted up fence, but the digs were even worse when I hit Detroit Street, where the Mexican stayed. Carletta called it the barrio and liked to cluck her tongue when we rolled by those crumbling down row houses. She liked to say she didn't understand how some people lived. I never bothered to point out we were just a few blocks away in a one-bedroom and that I didn't know whether to say I slept in the living room or the kitchen because the couch was technically in both. The irony would have been lost on Mama, who always said we had an open floor plan. Like we lived in some magazine house where everything was spread out nice and all the fabric matched the throw pillows. Like we put out bowls of decorative fruit just because. It's not that I minded the couch. I slept like a baby. It's just that Carletta had a way of denying certain realities to make her life seem like more than it was, which was sort of like coping, but was mostly just another way to lie.
That's Durham author Travis Mulhauser reading from his debut novel, Sweet Girl. Sardonic humor also throughout this book.
Yeah. The humor is a... I love humor in what I read as a consumer.
Yeah.
And I love the compliment that the book is funny in spots, especially when you don't expect it to be.
Yeah.
And I definitely never sat down and tried to write something funny. It just sort of happened that way.
No, but you get the sense that that's one of the weapons in Percy's arsenal as she makes this journey.
Absolutely. And it's a good coping mechanism, and I think it's true to her character, that ability to sort of find levity where she can.
So how did that happen? Tell us about the process of taking this image that won't let go of you, a girl in a hoodie rescuing a baby, and how did she become Percy James?
Well, I sort of messed it up at first. I spent a lot of time writing about other characters sort of periphery to her, and then I kept coming back to her. I think it's probably bears mentioning that I taught community college in Johnston County for a long time, 7 years, and I was really struck by the students there, young kids, a lot of them, and the way that they sort of viewed the world, the way that they were able to make meaning out of difficult circumstances. Community college students often are you know, a different sort of demographic than your typical university. And they would write these 3 to 5 page essays, and they would have a distinctive voice and interesting things to say. They might not have the best grammar, but they had a unique worldview that I really was interested in and that struck me. And I loved how sort of tough and scrappy they were and how they would write essays about, you know, horrific things happening sometimes. And there was no note of sort of self-pity or even realizing that they had the right to complain about what had happened. It was just all cope, and to find meaning. And some of that was just because they're trying to wrap up an essay.
Right.
3 to 5 pages long. I got to give the guy something here at the end. But a lot of Percy came from that, sort of my admiration for those students.
It's interesting to think about, isn't it, who Percy would have been, or if Percy could have actually come to life had you not had that experience. In other words, she could easily be a sentimental character who, frankly, we would lose interest in pretty quickly.
Sure. And she's definitely like a lot of Northern Michigan in her, yeah, too. And the girls I grew up with, who were many of them super tough, they fished, they hunted, they threw punches sometimes.
Ripped off liquor store.
Yes,
went down the canoe.
Right.
Whatever it was again. I wonder if I can ask you to read again for us.
Sure. So this is Percy. She's taken, found this baby and run out into this blizzard, and she gets sort of turned around. I might have known better what to do if I'd have been a Girl Scout. I'd always envied those little snots in grade school with their smart uniforms and badges and altruistic fundraisers for starving African babies. I'd also envied them their mothers, who all looked like Sandra Bullock and wore Pilates pants when they came to homeroom to recruit new members. I'd badly wanted to join, but I knew they didn't mean me when they asked if anybody was interested in becoming a scout. Yes, there was surely a world of information I would have had at my disposal had my childhood not been spent caring for Carletta and worrying over Cutler Family Services, wondering when they might finally arrive to take me and my sister Star away for good. I suppose the Girl Scouts would have known exactly what to do in my very situation, though none of them would ever have occasion to be there in the first place, Sandra Bullock moms not being the type to vanish after trading their daughter's cell service for a few rocks of methamphetamine. Ironies abounded out there in the fields, but I resisted the urge to indulge in their bitterness as I stood up and returned to my march.
Travis Mulhauser reading from his debut novel, Sweet Girl. And there we had, you mentioned Carletta, who is Percy's mom. She begins the search in a crack house, and the crack dealer, the owner of this house, is someone who becomes a somewhat sympathetic character for us. Tell us about Shelton.
Yeah, well, I ended up liking Shelton as a character.
I said, is it meth?
Yeah, it's meth, right?
House.
Yeah,
it's methamphetamine, right?
That's sort of the same end result with those two substances.
Right. But we're talking about rural Michigan.
Yep.
This is the rural drug, not the urban drug.
Yeah. So, yeah, Shelton... was a fun character to write for me. And I have to give a little credit here. I should give a lot of credit, but for this in particular, to my wife, she's a death penalty attorney. And so one thing I've learned from watching her do her work, she represents people on death row, is how much there are to people beyond the worst things that they've done. Like you hear about these people, and Shelton does some horrific things, but in other moments, he is a nice guy who has thoughts about, you know, who has sort of empathy, and who, you know, in his own mind, in his own sort of drug-addled confusion, he's sort of the hero of this story. And I think that, you know, I think people do bad things, but Shelton is a guy that did bad things, but also had so much other parts of his character that were frankly more interesting to me, too, than a real sort of black and white, this is a bad guy that does bad things. And I think certainly there are some people that are maybe more along those lines. But Shelton, and he also reminded me of some guys I grew up with who had made mistakes, but would also say things that were just absolutely hilarious and sometimes smart and sometimes sort of wise. And I wouldn't call Shelton wise, but yeah, so that's sort of where I went with his character.
How much of that was there from the start, and how much of that kind of evolved as the story progressed?
Shelton wrote himself. He was like the easiest part of the book. And I had actually written about him for a different project that he didn't end up quite fitting in, and he sort of popped up here in this book. And his voice and his whole worldview came very easily to me, and I don't know what that says about me personally, but he sort of, those sections came really easily.
Well, it says a lot in the sense that we do underestimate and undervalue, and I think find ourselves creating very narrow niches for individuals, parts of the country. I mean, when you think about the part of the country you're writing about, certainly there are a lot of meth novels out there.
Yeah, yeah.
But all of this points to an America, a very large portion of America, dispossessed, white and black, and that poverty is driving people to some very crazy behavior. And these are all human beings. And unfortunately, the political discourse puts everybody in a silo, but we are all, and a growing number of Americans, sharing this kind of poverty and dispossession. I mean, it's part of the story, it seems to me.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. And I think I didn't sit down to write a book about, you know, poverty and poor people, but I like books about poverty and poor people, and I wish there were more of them. And I think their sort of estrangement creates these situations. And some of it is like logistics as a writer. There's a lot of problems you don't have if you have money. That just takes a lot of things off the table. You know, there's a lot of stuff right. You can avoid. And so, like, for this story, you know, these things don't happen to people with money. And that's, you know, as a writer, there's some payoff there for me.
Well, it gets back to something you said earlier. If you wrote a book about poverty, you know, and about drug abuse, that easily becomes a sentimental book that nobody wants to read. If you write a book about human beings
right.
in actual settings that we might recognize, who then do surprising things and make us wonder if we have not sold people short,
right?
That's a good book.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right.
How did you talked about teaching. And in fact, you had kind of a funny story. I want to take you back to this because you came here from Michigan, right? You went to UNC and you thought you were going to Chapel Hill?
Yeah, I thought I was going to UNC Chapel Hill. I was like a super I've never been good at forms and filling things out and basically doing the logistics of life. So I applied thinking, "Oh, well that's probably Chapel Hill," which I knew of through, you know, sports. And so I got down here and I realized they were actually different colleges, which was fine.
Yeah.
Like I didn't, you know, but that came as a surprise to
good
me.
Good program up there at UNCG.
I cannot say enough good things about UNCG.
So how about you as a teacher? You've got now your debut novel is getting some great reviews and you've got some terrific blurbs, some good people behind you. Ron Rash has written about it and others. How do you teach this stuff? And does it change the way you teach to know that you've got a, you know, you've published something?
Well, I don't teach anymore. I stopped teaching like January, I think, of 14 after I sold the novel. And part of that is, you know, we have two small kids and my wife has a really demanding job and some flexibility is helpful. And, you know, after teaching for 14 years in academics as sort of an adjunct or a lecturer, I was ready to move on, I think, in a lot of ways.
What's next?
I'm just writing now and working on another book about Cutler County.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. I can't get away from there.
But, you know, speaking of can't get away, this is something I meant to ask you a minute ago, which was about that haunting image of yours.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, really, did that sort of wake you up in the middle of the night? How did that thing emerge, and what did you do about it? I mean, that's a strange picture for a man to have, isn't it?
I know. It would be interesting to me and nobody else to do a psychological study on where that image came from. Because I literally have no idea, but I think things all the time that are completely disjointed from reality, and that just happened to be one that I fixated on. But it was like a weird, arresting, powerful image that I sort of couldn't let go. And I don't know, you know, I've actually heard Ron Rash talk about images and that sit with him. Right. And maybe that's a unique thing with writers. I'm not sure. But I don't have a science to where that came from.
Well, I am curious about this. We'll make the science on the air right here live.
All right,
let's do it.
You've
had an initial image. You don't know what it is. It comes to you all of a sudden. Now you're starting to write a book. You're threading out. You're making a character. Does that image change? Does that initial picture change? Does it go away?
That's a really good question. I feel like these are really, really good questions.
Well, you think about them and come back. No, seriously.
No, I'm good. I'm good. The image doesn't change, but I would get distracted from it.
I see.
Because of thoughts you have, like, what's the agent going to say, or what's the editor going to think, or what do I need to do? Yeah. And then you got to come back to that image and sort of follow it. And I don't write with an outline. I don't know where it's going. So that's, you know, and just following that image is sort of what leads you to the book.
Travis Mulhouser is talking with us about his debut novel, Sweet Girl. You can find out more information about Travis and his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Travis, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking
to us. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.